Proverbs this evening and take some time looking again at some of the wisdom that's been saved for us here. Last time we were together, we looked at the first several Proverbs, and I'd like to just read without comment those as we head into the fourth this evening. The wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion. Because of the transgression of a land, many are its princes, but by a man of understanding and knowledge, right will be prolonged. A poor man who oppresses the poor is like a driving rain which leaves no food. Now, before we read this next verse, it was interesting. I was reading one of the commentaries that I use, and they pointed out that there are six references in the book of Proverbs to the Mosaic law. There are references to law throughout, but specifically to the Mosaic law, there are only six of those. Five are found in chapters 28 and 29. So they're kind of a gaggle of those references right here. The first of those is here in verse 4, where Solomon writes, "Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them." William MacDonald pointed out, "People who throw off the restraint of God's law and of civil law often praise the wicked." And as I pondered that a while this again, some of last week, but this week again, I thought, you know, that is really true, isn't it? You throw those things off, and it's not just an immoral, neutral decision that's done. But I wonder if we shouldn't think a little closer about what it is that leads to the praising of the wicked, as Solomon mentions it here in the first part of this verse. It seems to me that the sequence is, first of all, people forsake God's written law, his express instruction, this is right, this is wrong, do this, don't do that. And then once that absolute direction from God is set aside and disregarded, then it's natural to take the next step, which is to do the same with civil law. I mean, if he is the epitome, the ultimate authority, and we disregard what he is saying, why would it be a stretch then to disregard a lesser authority? And so when people turn away from obeying God's commands, they usually begin to praise and side with wicked people. Derek Kidner said something that reminded me of what was Patrick Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a senator or a congressman? Do you remember? Senator. And at one point you may remember as we began, well, I don't know if this one began, but he observed the moral slide that was taking place. And even he is at that point and that particular party observed and said, you know, we're defining deviancy downward, which is an accurate, you know, this used to be the standard here. And in order to rectify what's going on and make us feel better, we'll define the standard a little lower and then a little lower and then a little lower, in order to make us feel good about it. So Derek Kidner points out, without revelation, all is soon relative. Think about that a minute. Without revelation, all is soon relative. You know, it's right for you, but it doesn't mean that it's right for me. If it's right for me, it's not necessarily right for you. So if you want to hold a high view of life and it's you know, it's wrong to kill children, you know, I think it's a little strange, but if that's what you want to do, that's all right. That's okay for you. But I don't see that way. Without revelation, all is soon relative, and with moral relativity, nothing merits attack, quite merits attack. So the things that are worth standing up for become fewer and fewer. You know, it's just not worth the fuss. You know, don't rock the boat here. Somebody quipped years ago, those who aren't willing to stand for something are usually willing to fall for anything. And it's interesting, isn't it? What was it Chesterton said years ago? By the way, he was a Catholic, but he had I think he observed things very nicely at times, and he observed that when people no longer believe in God, it's not that now they believe nothing, but they'll believe anything. And it's that's the ilk of what this is getting at. In fact, Derek Kidner was saying, so for example, here is a tyrant that we accept because he can get things done. You know, that was a real surprise. One of the history glimpses that we put out some couple of years ago, was it, focused on pre-World War II Germany and what it was like, and why was it that Hitler got in power, and how many who were even Christians voted for him when he first came in, because of the moral slide that was going on in Germany, including, by the way, there was an increased openness with homosexuality. That was an interesting thing to me. And he said, you put me in power, and I'll take care of that. So one of the things he promised. And so people said, man, it was desperate times. The economy was really, it didn't just bottom out. The bottom dropped out in Germany. It was really hard times. And when that happens to a culture, somebody comes along and says, I promise hope and change, not just when a little bit happens, but when a lot of the masses will do that. And so that's happened. Well, here's the benefit of God's word, though, in the life of an individual or a family or a community or a nation. As we look at this verse, it's true. The first part says that those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them. Those who keep the law don't roll over and play dead because they're spiritually alive. There's light there. There's salt there. And light doesn't coexist with darkness. One has to go. And so because their spiritual life in this segment, their lives, their words, their actions are a kind of salt and light in the culture and society. On July the 4th, I read a blog by a fellow named Jonathan Parnell entitled The Gospel's Influence on the American Republic. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd just like to share a couple paragraphs from this with you. He writes, the founders of the United States of America were not trying to create a Christian nation in 1776. But they did view the Christian faith as beneficial to the type of republic they hoped to form. The man who led the way in articulating this benefit was a man named John Witherspoon, a Presbyterian minister, an influential founder who flies under the radar of most American history classes. Witherspoon contended that the contribution of true religion, as he called it, when the old men talked about true religion and our founders, they were talking about Christianity. All right. The contribution of true religion to the public order is morality of its people. If we're to translate this into our contemporary lingo, we'd say something like this. The gospel's influence on society is transformed lives. In fact, when I read that again, this past week, I thought about what Patrick Lewis was sharing with us and the different testimonies that he shared from the students that had come through IUPU. I hear people that came in just with a lot of open minds. I mean, that's where our culture is. That's where young people come in. And the gospel is presented, and eventually they come to faith. And, man, they have a whole nother direction, and their lives take on purpose. And it's really, really a wonderful change that way. Well, Witherspoon's explanation is really a piece of applicable logic. This person quotes also from one of his biographers, Jeffrey Morrison, and he gives a summarizing line and quotes Witherspoon. He says, religious leaders were to play a vital role, perhaps even more important than the laws themselves in a Republican society. The return which is expected from them to the community is that by the influence of their religious government, their people may be the more regular citizens and the more useful members of society. I hope none here will deny that the manners of the people in general are to be the utmost significance to the stability of any civil society. When the body of people are altogether corrupt in their manners, the government is ripe for destruction. Good laws may hold the rotten bark some longer together, but in a little time, all laws must give way to the tide of popular opinion and be laid prostrate under universal practice. Therefore, it clearly follows that the teachers and rulers of every religious denomination are bound mutually to each other and to the whole society to watch over the manner of their various members. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them. By the way, I read another quote by St. Augustine recently, who wrote, "The only things which evil men count as evil are those which do not make men evil. The only things which evil men count as evil are those things which do not make men evil." Is that connecting? I'm sorry? Okay. The only things which evil men count as evil are those which do not make men evil. Here's an evil guy, and, oh, you're a cutthroat like me? Come on in, brother. But it's the very things that hold up righteousness that they count as evil. Augustine lived in the first half of the first millennium. You mean they were that way back then? Maybe we all have the same natures or something, you think? Any comments or observations or questions? Boy, I can tell this is flying high tonight. Let's do one more here. Seems to me that really verse 5 has a close connection with verse 4. Just as it's true that those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them, so verse 5, evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all. So here's a question. Is this one of the reasons why we find ourselves scratching our heads when those who are of that particular ilk seem so bent on being tolerant and lenient with some of the worst offenders who've done some of the most perverted things in society? I mean, here are people who are worthy of capital punishment, and we need to be tolerant and lenient. We got to help them along. And yes, they might be some of the very same people who are willing to exterminate the most innocent among us. I mean, is it me, only me, that says scratch it? What in the world? How do you come up with that? If you would, keep your place here and turn to Psalm 119 just for a minute to get a perspective here. Folk at the Bible Knowledge Commentary wrote that when people disobey the law and therefore the Lord, their sense of uprightness and morality is twisted, it's perverted. And so they find it difficult even to understand, Solomon says here, have insight into justice. But on the other hand, those who are righteous, those who are seeking the Lord, have a keen sense of justice. That's the point here. While you're still there, we're getting into about the middle of Psalm 119 in a moment. Another thought here from William MacDonald. By refusing to practice God's law, or as James says it in his epistle, refusing to be a doer of God's word, merely a hearer of the word, people lose the power to understand it. But those who seek the Lord and His will, as it's revealed in His word, are given powers of discernment. That is, when we are, in fact, seeking it, when we're doing it, it expands our appreciation of it and our discernment of it. And there's a close link between the morality of this thing and the understanding of it. So here in Psalm 119, look at verse 100. The writer says, I understand more than the ancients. Why? Because I keep your precepts. Because I'm a doer of the law. In fact, the psalmist not only says that with full confidence, but look over a few verses later. Psalm 105, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. He can not only say that with complete confidence, but in verse 100, I have more understanding than the ancients because I keep your precepts. There's something about doing that that augments and gives us further insight. Now, let me stop there a minute. Evil men don't understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all. Comments or observations? Well, in that case, let's stop there.